Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta.
Now, wait a minute. I'd like to propose a toast to my family. Someday soon, you're gonna have families of your own. And if you're lucky, you'll remember the little moments. Like this. That were good. Cheers.
That's James Gandolfini as New Jersey mob boss Tony Soprano. The Sopranos premiered on HBO on January 10th, 1999, and TV has not been the same since. The show's creator, David Chase, wasn't a fan of television, so he decided to transform TV into cinema. Matt Zoller-Seitz and Alan Sepinwall were handling the TV beat for the Newark Star-Ledger when the series began. They had a front-row seat to the show and launched a new era in TV criticism with their artful analysis. They've compiled their work into the book, The Sopranos Sessions. Here's Seitz.
It was an unbelievable stroke of good fortune that I happened to end up at that particular paper at that particular time with the background that I had being a film critic who was fairly new to television criticism. And my the first time I ever met David was fall of 1998, and they were shooting a scene on Roosevelt Island off of Manhattan. And the interview was me and him sitting in folding metal chairs out on the edge of the water, and it was cold and plumes of breath were coming out of our mouths. And he was talking about Fellini and Antonioni and Godard and all of these European art house cinema filmmakers who shaped him. And I thought, I've never had a conversation like this with anyone who produced a television show before. And how amazing that the circumstances are like something that you would see in one of the films he's describing.
Yeah. And The Sopranos really launched your careers for you, in which both of you elevated the art of the recap. You transformed the recap into the episode review. And there are a lot of other critics doing this now. How do you both feel about being the pioneers of this format?
It's a strange thing. I remember I started doing it in college, even before The Sopranos, for the cop show NYPD Blue. Mm. And I, in turn, was inspired by a math teacher named Tim Lynch, who was recapping Star Trek episodes. And I remember I read those and I thought, wait, you can just write about an episode of television? But it really wasn't until we were each writing about The Sopranos for the paper that I feel like I came into my own in doing this. Like, I would come in on a Monday, someone got whacked in the episode the night before, and I would say to my editors, people are going to want to talk about this. Save me some space on the Tuesday front page, and I'm going to write about it. And those always got a much bigger response than anything else I wrote for the paper, including advanced reviews of Soprano seasons. And I realized there is an appetite for this. For a show this complex, people want to talk about it long past the time they spent watching it.
Mm. I was able to convince my editors at the Star-Ledger to let me write about individual episodes, like basically episode reviews. But there had to be some special justification for it. And often it was that, you know, some major event, some kind of obviously event that was obviously flagged as being major had happened, like, you know, somebody gave birth or some important character died. Like, I wrote an episode review of the NYPD Blue when Jimmy Smits died. Mm. And I did an episode, pieces on like season finales and things like that. And, you know, episodes of ER where they would kill people off in a grisly fashion, I might write something about that, or the West Wing episode Two Cathedrals, which was, you know, great. I think Alan and I both would rank that among our favorite episodes of the time that we've been writing about TV. But I would often make the case of just like, especially when we got a website, why don't you let me recap everything? Why don't you just, since I'm watching the show anyway and I'm looking for every excuse I can to write about it, why don't I just write about every episode? And the answer was, the readers don't want that. Well, it turns out that they did.
I think seeing him again will be very therapeutic for me.
It's not supposed to be therapeutic for you. This is your therapy here.
Do you have sexual feelings for him?
No. I have feelings. On a personal level.
Why do you think that such a large audience let these sociopathic, unlikable characters into their homes for 8 years?
First, it was great.
They were funny. That helped. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. They were funny. Gandolfini gave the greatest performance in TV drama history. You know, he was so charismatic. Edie Falco, Nancy Marchand, Lorraine Bracco, Dominic Chinese. So many of the performances in the show were fantastic. It was well-written. It was well-directed. Like, and obviously, quality will not always guarantee an audience. But it was sort of this perfect storm where before The Sopranos, the approach to getting a big audience in TV is the lowest common denominator approach. You dumb things down. You sand off the edges. You make everything as palatable and simply easy to digest as possible for people. This went the other way. This went really complex in terms of morality, in terms of characterization, storytelling, everything. But it covered so many different, like, you know, parts of the Venn diagram. Mm. So you had you brought in the people who just wanted a gangster story. You brought in the people who could relate to the family drama of the Soprano family.
And it's very deliberate that Chase saying, like, he wanted this to appeal to women.
Yes.
He didn't want it to be just a bunch of sweaty guys whacking each other. Like, it was very important to him that his wife and his family and everybody in the domestic sphere be equally important.
Yeah, and there was a lot of fans who just wanted the mob show and would get impatient with that, or with the psychiatry and the dream episodes and all of those things. But the show was all of it, so it had these different constituencies who together, stitched together, became this huge audience and became this phenomenon that changed television as we know it.
It did something that movies had been doing since the 60s. Really since the late 60s and on through the 70s and beyond, which was giving you a main character who was complicated and charismatic and maybe even funny and entertaining, but was not supposed to be somebody who exemplified the correct way to live. You know, he wasn't a role model. And it was okay. It became, after a certain point, okay to have an anti-hero as your main character in a movie. It had been okay to have an anti-hero as a main character in on the stage and in novels for, you know, hundreds of years. But television, for some reason, remained immune for that. And with very few exceptions, many of them unsuccessful. And even on shows that were largely driven by the antics of a villain or an anti-hero, like, say, Dallas, or Oz, which preceded The Sopranos on HBO by 2 years, you still had characters who were, in theory, the main characters who were the good people. Mm. You know, like they represented the institution.
Yeah.
And you didn't have that here, and you had to decide, like, how did that make you feel? Like, to sound like Melfi, but, like, now that you're empathizing with this murderous, you know, thief and serial philanderer and glutton and all these other, you know, qualities that we think are unflattering, how does that make you feel? Do you feel good when you look in the mirror that you're so interested in this person?
There you go, yeah. You both have compiled top 10 lists of your favorite Sopranos episodes. Alan, you seem to favor the more plot-driven, climactic episodes. And Matt, you seem to gravitate toward the more meditative episodes. But you both have some episodes in common, including season one's College. Let's talk a bit about this episode. Alan, can you give us a brief synopsis of College and why it's your number one pick?
All right, so in College, there's two plots. One of them is Tony and Meadow are touring colleges in New England, and while they're in the midst of going from one place to another, Tony recognizes a guy named Febby Petrullio, a former family associate who turned rat, and he has gone into the witness protection program, and Tony decides he's going to get his revenge on Febby, and he hunts him down. And the other plot is Carmela is home with Father Phil, and there's a big rainstorm, and they spend a long sort of dark night of the soul together, and you wonder if they're going to sleep together, and Carmela is grappling with her feelings about her philandering husband and about being a mob wife.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 4 weeks since my last confession. What am I talking about? That's a lie. I haven't truly confessed in 20 years.
Go on.
I have forsaken what is right for what is easy. Allowing what I know is evil in my house. Allowing my children, oh my God, my sweet children, to be a part of it. Because I wanted things for them. I wanted a better life, good schools. I wanted this house. Wanted money in my hands, money to buy anything I ever wanted. I'm so ashamed.
This was the episode where the Sopranos really became the Sopranos. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the first four episodes are good, but if you read the reviews written off of those four episodes, they're kind of mixed to positive. They're intrigued by it, but really not sure, and the show is still figuring it out tonally. And then College, that was when everyone that Monday morning started raving and telling their friends, have you seen the show called The Sopranos? You have to see it. Because David Chase insisted that Tony kill Febby with his bare hands at the end of it, which had never really been done before in this kind of context on a show. And he took the character further than even HBO expected that he would. And he said, if he doesn't do this here, the audience will stop believing in him as this character I've created. And he was right.
You know how much trouble you're in now?
You took an oath and you broke it.
I could have killed you last night outside the motel. Your daughter was drunk, remember? I was there in the parking lot. I had a gun, but I didn't do it. Because of her, I told myself, it's just a coincidence. It's taking this little girl to college.
You know, one thing about us wise guys, the hustle never ends. You shot me at that motel, your life would have been flushed down a piece of dude.
Please, Tony, I'm begging.
Yeah, and in the book you say this is the purest distillation of the show's mafia family and domestic family themes in the ways that Tony's work in the mafia family utterly taints the family, the his personal family.
Well, and also
family.
the idea of dual identities, which mm-hmm. is important for at least three of those four major characters, Tony, Carmela, and Father Phil. And you know, the episode ends with Tony sitting out in a lobby waiting for his daughter to have an interview at one of the colleges that they're touring, and he looks up and he sees an inscription from Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, which, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says, basically, a person who wears one face for himself and another to the world will eventually become confused as to which is true.
Mm.
And that reflects on him, but also, of course, The Scarlet Letter is a story about a woman who falls in love with a priest.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's resonating on kind of a literary level as well.
Yeah. Another episode that showed up on both of your top 10 lists is probably the most popular Sopranos episode. It's called Pine Barrens, and it's from season 3. Can you guys set up this episode and tell us why it's so memorable?
Yeah, Pine Barrens is
there's an interior decorator.
Oh, yeah, he killed 15 Czechoslovakians, yeah.
His apartment looked terrible. No, Paulie and Christopher are sent to collect a debt.
16, sorry. 16
they're sent to collect a debt from, like, a Russian associate of the mob, and it goes bad quickly, and instead they wind up, they think that they've killed him. They decide to drive down to the Pine Barrens, which is a famous sort of enormous forest/nature preserve in southern New Jersey, to bury him. And they get there and they discover that he's still alive. And he manages to escape from them. And they get lost in the woods and don't know what to do.
Could be him out there stalking us.
Think about it, Chrissy. Even if he's alive, he's unarmed and bleeding like a sieve. He's in the woods. He's in his pajamas.
Probably thinks we left anyway.
If he's alive, which he ain't. What's that?
Nathan's bag.
There's some ketchups in. They clean?
I don't know. They were in the bag. They were a little halfway frozen.
Give me some. Not bad. Mix it with the relish.
And this is the beauty of it, and I don't think I fully grasped this until the rewatch, but, you know, everybody thinks of that as the episode where Paulie and Christopher are tangling with the Russian in the woods. And that is, in fact, the first thing you remember, because it's really funny and scary and just really well done by Steve Buscemi, who directed 4 episodes, all of which I think are excellent in their own way. But there's this larger story which encompasses it, which is the story of the effect of Tony's irresponsibility and absentee landlord kind of approach to his job, what that does to everybody else, like whether it's his wife, his mistress, his children, or the underlings who work for him. They're all suffering from inattention of this guy who's supposed to be paying attention and supposed to be listening, and he's just too selfish and distracted to do his job in any sense.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we can't talk about The Sopranos without talking about the series finale, an episode called Made in America. How does this very last episode of The Sopranos end?
Oh, I like how you phrased that. Well, it ends with the family. It ends with the family in Holston's Diner in Bloomfield, New Jersey, eating onion rings, and it looks like a perfectly ordinary dinner out. But it's shot and cut in an extremely menacing, suspenseful way. Like, can you feel that something horrible could happen at any moment? Even though, as Alan and I talked about in our dialogue about this episode in the book. There's actually no data in the scene to indicate that anybody in the family is more anxious than they would normally be if they were eating out. And even the behavior of most of the characters on the show, if you just look at the actions, which is guy at the counter looks at a family, gets up and goes to the restroom. That happens a million times in diners across the United States. Why do we think that that's important? Well, it's because of the way it's shot. And it's one of the 2 episodes that David Chase directed. But I will say that, you know, the question of what happened in the end, I think that's as Chase himself put it a few years ago when he felt that another journalist had misquoted him about what happened. It's a spiritual question that has no correct answer.
It was work today.
All I'm doing is getting coffee and placing English phone calls.
You may not realize it, but you are making contacts.
It's an entry-level job. So buck up. All right. Focus on the good times.
Don't be sarcastic.
Isn't that what you said one time? Try and remember the times that were good?
I did.
Yeah, Well, it's true, I guess.
And that's not to say that he doesn't have certain inclinations, which Alan and I teased out of him. Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah. We were interviewing him, and we did 7 long interviews over the course, 1 for each season. And we knew we would have to deal with the end in the last of those. Mm-hmm. And we've talked to him a lot. He hates discussing the finale. He usually clams up. Yeah. So we hadn't come up with a strategy yet. And then we were doing the 6th interview. And we weren't talking about the finale at all. We were talking just in general about planning for the ending, but not actually doing the ending. And suddenly, without warning, Chase says the phrase, "Well, I had that death scene planned about 2 years before we actually did it."
Yes.
And he kept talking, and he gives this answer. And at the end of it, Matt Zoller-Seitz says, "David, you realize you just referred to that as a death scene?"
Mm-hmm.
And Chase realized what he had said, and he glares at both of us. And then, you know, almost with a laugh, he says something that I cannot say on the radio. And we all laughed. And then, to our amazement, it was like once he had said that, the dam burst, and he was willing to talk to us for about 45 minutes. And it turned out death scene was actually referring to a completely different ending that he didn't do, that he abandoned. But it does sort of speak to the idea that the scene at the ice cream parlor is about death, whether or not Tony dies, you know, which at this point I'm not really interested in that answer. I'm just interested in the way it makes me feel and what it makes me think about.
Yeah. Well, and one of my favorite parts of this job is the chance to interview creative people and ask them about the craft aspect of what they do. And, like, what were you trying to do here? Were you able to execute it to your satisfaction? Was there any part of it that maybe that you changed in the process, and if so, why? Like, all of these kinds of, you know, like, if somebody was building a redwood deck on the back of their house, you would ask them these sorts of questions. And these are the kinds of ones that I live for. And the answers are always really illuminating for me. And what I discovered with Alan interviewing David Chase is he was extremely intentional about certain things and very much going by instinct or intuition with other things, and sometimes a little bit of both. And also, just, you know, going back to the idea of psychoanalysis being important on this show, I think it's really important in the creative process and as critics to sort of understand how the human mind works. And you and I, throughout our lives, do things on purpose that we didn't mean to do. Like, mm-hmm. we look back over it and we go, like, wow, that feels like an accident. That feels like a coincidence. But in retrospect, maybe I meant to do that. And I think the ending is a perfect case of that. Like, I completely believe David, and I understand his frustration when he says that he originally had this kind of oblique scene in mind that was supposed to be interpreted as he died.
That was the Lincoln Tunnel idea?
Tony was, the last scene of the show was going to be Tony driving through the Lincoln Tunnel for a meeting with Johnny Sack, the New York mob boss. And the scene was either going to cut to black or fade to white. I can't remember which. But it was definitely going to feel like a note of finality somehow. And I think you would come away from that going, well, he probably didn't come back from that meeting. Like, we don't see the meeting, but the implication is that whatever it was, it didn't go well for Tony. Mm-hmm. And he moved away from that. He very deliberately moved away from that. And one of the reasons he moved away from that was he thought it was too easy and too cliched to kill the gangster hero at the end of the gangster story, and he didn't want to do that. So he moved away, and he eventually settled on this Holston's thing. However, you know, and I asked him a bunch of extremely explicit follow-up questions because I didn't want him to be misconstrued. And one of them was, is it possible that even though you deliberately moved away from this idea of Tony getting killed, a lifetime of consuming gangster movies where the guy gets killed at the end might have still given this whole scene a feeling of they killed him? And he said, yeah, that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
So he may have meant to, he may have killed Tony without meaning to kill Tony. You know, like, mm-hmm. it's like another Freudian slip, except on a grand scale.
Yeah. What is the Sopranos legacy?
The Sopranos legacy is what television is right now. Like,
yeah.
That show you binged on Netflix over the weekend, that does not exist without The Sopranos. You know, that comedy you watched with a relatively unlikable lead character, that doesn't exist without The Sopranos. Extreme serialization in television, all of the things that we think scripted TV has become in these last 20 years can be traced to the success of this show, because there were all these unwritten rules about how television was supposed to function and what the audience would and would not accept. And the success of the show revealed all of those rules to be incorrect.
Well, and to build on something that Alan said earlier, you know, this was a show, because it was a hit, for whatever reason, you know, everybody had a different reason why they watched the show. But because it was a big hit, it gave other people who made television permission to make the kind of show that gave the audience what it wanted, not what they thought the audience wanted. That was really important. And I love that. And that's one of the reasons why the show is dear to my heart and why many of the recent shows that I love so much are also in that vein, like shows like Atlanta and The Americans, because I like a show that tells me who's boss, you know, that doesn't give me what it thinks I want. It gives me what it wants. And it's up to me to decide if I like it or not. Like, I respect a show that has the guts to be that.
Yeah. What would you guys tell someone who's never watched The Sopranos to convince them that they should watch it?
Because its DNA can be found in every show they have liked, in the recent years.
Yeah.
I would say that, and this is true for me, is like I look at television and I look at myself differently as a result of having watched The Sopranos.
That's New York Magazine's Matt Zoller-Seitz and Rolling Stone's chief TV critic, Alan Sepinwall. They are the authors of The Soprano Sessions. You can find out more about Matt and Alan on our website, wpr.org/beta.
Ultimately, I just wanted to like sugarcoat ideas about consent and have people talking about consent.
Comedian Jenna Friedman offers us a light touch on hard issues. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.